You've been a very famous writer now for a long time, and it's about time we knew something about you. Who's S.J. Perelman?
Well, I guess I have to make what the IRS calls a full disclosure. I was, I'm a transplant, actually. I was born in a remote gubernia of Manhattan called Brooklyn. And at the age of about 6 months, I was slung across the bridge of my father's nose and transported to Rhode Island, where for the next 21 years, I was a typical inhabitant of Little Rhody. My father was an extremely interesting man, not only to me, but to most of the people who know him. He had emigrated from southern Russia. He came from Odessa in 1892, and he had done a variety of things in his lifetime. One of his first exploits in this country was to start off to be an engineer. He had hoped to attend Columbia, but due to some trouble in his immediate family or whatever, and a genuine lack of funds, he wound up as third engineer on a Ward Line steamer, which plied between New York and Havana, called the Morro Castle. And in fact, his was the first ship to enter the harbor of Havana after the sinking of the Maine. Now it was thereafter his life. He met and married my mother, who had come from the northern part of Russia, from what was called Vitebsk Gubernia, and from a tiny village in that province. Oddly enough, years later, when I met Marc Chagall, I found that Chagall had come from a hamlet just a few miles distant from the place my mother was born, and we naturally got together in a big way. anyway, my father worked as a machinist, as generally things involved with mechanics and so forth, and eventually came to be the owner of a small dry goods store in Providence. And that's almost my first memory of things. He was, needless to say, not very interested in the dry goods business. I recall him chiefly in the back room of this establishment studying the stock market reports. I believe that he was already dabbling in this. And in fact, there's a somewhat dramatic story in I think it was in 1916, when I was about 12, the United States was sort of trembling on the edge of entry into the First World War. And my father had 750 shares of Bethlehem Steel on margin. And of course, it was very dodgy about whether the United States would go in or stay out and so forth. And he had to raise money to cover. And he made his way to New York, and he actually saw Henry Clews, Sr., the great financier. How he did this, I have no idea. And Clews said to him, "Whatever you do, hang on to this stock." He said, "Sell your wife into the South American export trade. Put your boy in a coal mine, but hang on to this damn stock." Well, my father couldn't. I forget what the stock rose to, but it was something astronomical. And this is that kind of story that you always love about how close your folks ever got to making any money. At any rate, my father nourished the that great American conception, I should say the conception of the Jewish American, that a small chicken farm was the gateway to paradise. And so his next step was to buy a tiny place on the outskirts of Providence called Norwood. Needless to say, every hand was against him, especially the chickens' hands. He was raising, what were they now? White Wyandottes, they were white leghorns. And I think that my earliest and continuous hatred of the chicken was engendered by those years. They are the most contemptible, cannibalistic, unfeeling beasts in the aviary. I can't properly vent my spleen against the chicken. And of course, chickens are the natural target of other things besides myself. Every so often, a mink would appear and decimate the flock, or the east wind would suddenly come up, and the tiny baby chicks would go over on their side and pass out. And so this was the last period of my father's life, which coincided with my entry into and my stay at Brown University. Now, meanwhile, back at the ranch, I was becoming educated forcibly. Went to a place called the Candace Street Grammar School on the west side of Providence. And I don't want to get a lot of letters from people telling me it's on the north side or the south. It's really a relatively minor detail, so let's have none of your sass. I went to this for about 4 years and then entered the Glasgow High School, which was a fine, respectable, moss-covered institution, and stayed there for 4 years. The chief knock there at that time, and this was in the years 1917 to 1921, was the fact that the teaching of German had been forbidden out of patriotism, and Greek was substituted. And so I was forcibly compelled to study Greek along with the 4 years of Latin and all this. And however noble a language Greek is, and my daughter reads it and admires it greatly and speaks with veneration of it, it's no light task to have to translate 50 lines of the Iliad at night after you've done, say, 100 lines of Latin and try to cope with mathematics and a lot of other stuff. So I guess that I really had to apply my nose to the grindstone, though it obviously made no perceptible difference in the size of my nose. Any rate, I got out of there with a whole skin. I was interested chiefly in English. I was doing a lot of reading, and I was very fortunate in knowing a couple of other fellows there who had a great influence on me. One of them was a man named Israel Capstein, who has since become a teacher at, professor at Brown University, and was retired last year, and was probably one of the most popular men ever to teach at Brown. Well, Capstein and I, and a third friend, whose name was Orlyansky. His father was a mole, if you dig what I mean. That is to say, a rabbi who has certain special functions at the christening of a Jewish child. Orlyansky used to tell us that his name actually meant Laughing Eagle. So Capstein and myself and the Laughing Eagle were kind of friends and knocked around together, gave ourselves terrible airs, you know. I mean, we were athletes to outdo Oscar Wilde or Max Beerbohm, but we read all that stuff. You see, the 90s were still not very remote. This was not, I suppose, two decades after the flowering of the yellow 90s. So it was perfectly natural that we were aware of this stuff and so on. And from Glasgow High School, we moved on to Brown University. And I say moved on because there literally was no money for us to go elsewhere. We would have all preferred to have gone to Harvard. But we were townies, as it's called, and therefore subjected to a certain amount of derision and patronage by those wealthy boys who came up from New Paltz, New York, and Boston Spa, and places like that. It immediately became clear to me on entering Brown that there was a great opportunity to do the thing that I had done from childhood, which was to draw. While back at my father's dry goods store, I had begun drawing cartoons on those rectangular bits of cardboard that are stuck into rolls of gingham, you know, that the kind of stiffening. I had been doing these cartoons, and I kept on drawing, not seriously, but being interested in humor and whatnot. When I asked at that time, about the age of 12 or 13, what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would unashamedly say, I want to be a cartoonist. And this excited such derisive laughter from all the people in that's to say, friends of my parents and everything else. My parents accepted this as a perfectly reasonable idea. Everybody else thought that this was equivalent to being a night counterman in a cafeteria or something of that sort. They said, oh, well, you get over that. You'll be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. As I say, far from it. When I got to Brown, I discovered that there was a magazine there, a comic magazine, called The Brown Jug. I have to interject a little rather dull history. See, this was the period when the college comic magazines flourished. Up at Harvard, you had the Harvard Lampoon, Cornell Widow at Ithaca, Yale Record at New Haven, Princeton Tiger down in Princeton, and all through the Midwest and West. Each college had its own humorous magazine. And so I began drawing for this immediately my freshman year. There seemed to be some demand for artists. And so I kept on faithfully drawing. Not to extend the story too far, in my senior year, I was chosen editor of the magazine, and I had to take my place in the wheelhouse and guide this somewhat shaky craft to completion. And there was a lot of funny little things happened. For example, one day I was sitting in, trying to look very professional, a real editor, you know, with a green eye shade and a corncob pipe, which absolutely strangled me. I could barely puff at this thing. When suddenly the light was blotted out by this gigantic figure wearing that little brown beanie on the top of the head, which was freshman regulation. And this deep voice rolled out of this figure, and he said, is this the Brown Jug? And I acknowledged that it was, and he said, I draw pictures. I said, really? I said, what's your name? He said, John McLean. And I said, really? I said, where are you from, John? Are you from these parts? And he said, no, I've just transferred here. Let's drop the deep rumbling growl because I'm naturally falsetto and shrill. He said, yes, I draw. He said, if you need artists, he said, I'd like to show you my work. Well, of course, I fell on this because we were always short of artwork. So I told him to bring in his drawings. And he did so. He arrived the next day with three drawings. I took one look at them and I realized that these drawings were by a man named Lawrence Fellows, that they illustrated an advertising campaign for Kelly Springfield Tires. And in fact, he had copied them with such determination. He'd used about a 4H Hardmouth pencil, which had bit very deeply into the tracing paper. Do you see? It was perfectly obvious to me that these things were swiped. In fact, I had seen a couple of these in print, in adult magazines, so to speak. But we needed the work, and I took them. And I don't recall that he did many more for us, but this, of course, was the John McLean who later became first the ship news reporter for the New York Sun, afterward an intimate of a lot of very solvent people in this city, and finally the drama critic for the New York Journal American. And we remained good friends, and later on, in fact, I reminded him of this, and I gave him the Stock Direct. I said, now, McLean, face up to it. You lifted those drawings. And he smiled shyly and offered me another drink. I mean, but that was the type of thing that used to go on, and subsequently, not to draw it out too long. After I was graduated, I was beckoned to by Judge Magazine, which was one of the three famous humorous magazines of the epoch. There was Puck, there was Judge, and there was Life. And Norman Anthony of Judge sang sweet songs to me, bidding me to come down to New York and work for Judge. I interpreted this as an actual contract, but I learned in a year and a half of suffering that what he meant was that they'd buy the drawings if they liked them. During which gay period, I subsisted largely on donuts and cold coffee. However, I managed to stay alive, and subsequently, I did a lot of work for him. My drawings sort of naturally, I was using very elaborate captions on these drawings, and the captions got longer and longer, and finally I realized that I was actually writing and that the drawing was embellishment. So I then drew and wrote for them in total about 4 years, worked for a year for College Humor, which magazine was a repository of the best of all the college magazines, and I continued as an artist and writer up until 1930 when I fell afoul of the Marx Brothers and went out to Hollywood for the first time.
All right, we want to cut it there, Jack.
Do I have to stick to the cigar?
What's yeah, just for right now.
Oh, for right now, yeah.
He's making certain.
Yeah, sure.
And this is a definite.
You mean gesticulate with it? Okay, could you just make it? Yeah.
Well,
a small gesture.
Yeah.
From our old
That's
viewpoint.
That's too big. Oh. Tighter than that. Just a little movement of it. Yeah, like that.
Delicate. There's, to us, frankly, there's news value in the fact that we can say
we're back to the
on the first show.
Yeah. And mommy leaned over me, and I got a great waft.
It's bullshit.
What?
And then you know it's bullshit.
Right. So in my anxiety to avoid that particular kind of thing, I jumped ahead to my first meeting with the Marx Brothers, and started from there forward. Well, I shortly discovered that I was deliberately constricting myself. I mean, I was cutting my life in half, and it was a problem that puzzled me. So what I did then was to
yes, sir.
to finally evolve the notion of actually starting the book there, but then doing flashbacks into earlier periods. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of.
Well, you know, let's talk about this, about the move. I'm telling you that it has aroused enormous interest, not entirely over the fact that it was you, which was part of it. You're a very famous writer, and a celebrity. But people know, why are you leaving the country and to work in England?
Well, the reason I'm leaving the country has nothing to do, actually, except in a very minor way, with the state of the nation. About 3 years ago, I made up my mind that I was going to move to England for a number of considerations. I had spent a good deal of time there, and whenever I was traveling in Europe, I would ultimately wind up in London and see whatever of the country that I had the time and means to see. And I really, it sounds awfully corny to say that I fell in love with it, but in effect that's exactly what did happen. Physically, of course, England is a beautiful country. I was enchanted by the difference between manners, behavior, general deportment of the people, the difference between that in England and what I was beginning to see in my own country. Because we've all been conscious for a long time of the quickening of pace here, particularly in a metropolis like New York, or Chicago, or Los Angeles, whatever. The tempo has quickened, and the pace of living, the anxieties, and the depressions, and the general bitterness didn't start as bitterness, but it has now become bitterness and disaffection with the way the country is being run from the top and its effect upon people. It isn't totally a matter of this administration either. I mean, it's just sort of development out of the past. And it was, of course, coalesced by the war in Vietnam, which, of course, in my thinking, harks back to that great architect and that great mind, John Foster Dulles, who was the architect of everything that we're seeing now. And the whole notion of containment of this enormous opposite philosophy of communism, and particularly in China, has been proved to be so meretricious, so short-sighted, particularly because I do believe that an accommodation could have been reached a long time ago. And I have on very good authority the fact that John F. Kennedy was doing his best to move in that direction. But beginning with the China lobby and with the greediness and the short-sightedness of a great many of the powerful people in this country, we took a totally opposite position, and I think that we are now reaping the fruits of this entire policy. Well, I this sounds like a complete tangent to what I was saying, but in fact it isn't. And I think that all of this has had the most disastrous effects upon us now. And I, for the last 3 years, I had been sensing this restlessness and buildup of hatred around me and around everybody I knew. And I was becoming more and more, drawn to the ultimate conclusion that I would just like to go and live in England. Now, there are other reasons, because my particular profession, having to deal with words, must, in essence, originally come back to the fountainhead of the language. I hardly think that we speak with a well of English undefiled in this country. I mean, at best, we're speaking a strange patois that is only a reflection of what is spoken in England. And I don't, by spoken, I don't mean actually uttered with the mouth. I think that our journalism is an inferior reflection of theirs in a grammatical sense, and in a concision and a careful use of the language, a respect for the language. That's really what I'm groping for. And so, just as an American bootmaker might want to go to London to see how the real article is made with loving care, I wanted to go to England to see how my language should properly be used. Now, inevitably, in those very frequent and increasingly frequent trips that I had made to England, I had made a lot of friends. And I discovered that the cliché about the not hostility, but the coldness and the standoffishness of the English, that this was indeed a cliché. I know that I've been received as warmly in that country as it's possible for anybody to be. Admittedly, my work was appearing there, and on the whole, since there are more literate folk than we are, and since it's a small country, the total effect was magnified. So it's awfully hard to hate a country where you're well received and where every prospect pleases and only man is vile. As I say, I really felt at home there more and more and more. And about 3 years ago, I made up my mind that this was a move that I was facing, and was facing with a great deal of expectation. What I'm trying to also say at the same time, speaking with two tongues, is that recently I noticed that in the press it has been stressed that I'm leaving here in a state of umbrage, that I'm angry at the violence and all the things that we know are going on that I've mentioned before. This is really a most secondary reason for my leaving. The state of the nation as I leave, I think, is appalling. I think it's dangerous, and I'm very pessimistic about the immediate future. But it has nothing to do with my departure. And I propose, since I hate the word expatriate, I propose to revisit America, let's say the United States, as often and as frequently as possible, and to continue my work here. I intend to go on writing for The New Yorker, for which I've written so long and which I so admire. And I simply am, so to speak, striking the set and moving into another one.
That's a cut.
Boy, that was tremendous, Jesus. You never rehearsed anything like that?
Stand by to make the move.
Ease of creativity. In fact, it'll be easier for you to write over there.
There's no sound on this.
But here, I would like you to make the point that you made so well before about the fact that you're very gratified that young people appreciate, you know, what you're doing, that you actually found, in a sense, you know, well, you can't say, but, you know, good writing will be good any time, and I don't know who's to
go ahead.
I don't want to bother you, because he's got to get these moves straight.
Okay, Jerry, start right.
Is that generally all right?
Is that all right?
That was fine, sir.
Well, yeah, but then you want him now to put his coat back on and start.
No, you want to start with the coat off, right, Jay? Right, just leave the coat off.
Oh, yeah.
Just leave it there.
All right. Talk a little bit about your... your work, I mean, what you're doing, I mean, work in somewhere, I mean, the fact that it's important that you work in the fact, and I say it's important, that young people are reading your stuff and you're pleased with that. Talk a little bit more about the whole atmosphere in both places, because that was so marvelous, the effect of what happened, and the way you did it.
Jerry, don't
you
hand so much.
Nothing's wrong with anybody, but just talk about you.
Are we rolling?
Yes, sir.
But the way, yeah, we're rolling. Talk about your, about how you feel about working now.
Okay. Mr. Perlman, before you started, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Just pick up that ashtray and put it down.
It wasn't there when I made the move.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
You got a reason.
All right, hold it. Now we got a tech problem.
That one is great.
Oh. All right, we're going to have to make the ashtray move once again. We had some tech problems when you did that. So sit back. Okay, good. Now reach for the ashtray and put it on the couch.
Well, you know, I've been plying this strange craft for, according to some documents I have on my person, about 45 years. And I've gone through many phases on it. I've worked in a number of fields prose writing for magazines, and in the theater, and in Hollywood, and television. I've meanwhile continued to do the thing which I like to do best, which is writing for the printed page. And I suppose I like it best because the writer has complete autonomy, so to speak. If he writes for Hollywood, he is subject to the will and the whim of many other people, the director, the actors, and so forth. Second best to writing for the printed page, of course, is the theater. The dramatist today has great autonomy in the theater. He's able to pretty well get what he wants, subject to the necessities of production, of the lines that an actor can read, and to the general molding of the form for the theater audience. But I always return to my first love, so to speak, which is writing for the printed page, because there, the chances of getting 99 and 44/100 of what you write onto the page are very good. And I have at this point to send a mash note, a love letter, to the New Yorker magazine, because it's without any doubt, and this is commonly recognized, it is the very best edited magazine in the world. There's a great tradition of respect there for the written word. And that has been true ever since Harold Ross founded the magazine in 1925. It's been carried forward by the present editor, William Shawn. And there is the feeling that the writer is entitled to the respect of having all his words printed, only subject to the laws of grammar and the laws of accuracy. Well, In my particular slot, I don't have to be subject to the laws of accuracy, since I can use fantasy or satire or any of the other weapons at the command of the comic writer. As far as reception of my work is concerned, I've never been dissatisfied with that reception in the United States. I've always been gratified, indeed, by the quick willingness of people to laugh and the desire to be amused and entertained. And when I've managed to do that, it's been, in my eyes, a very considerable achievement. One of the things I was always dubious about, or have been for some years now, was exactly what the attitude of youth was about this. Because you see, my work depends to a great extent upon illusion. In other words, I go off at tangents, I bring in names of people, places, things which are often unfamiliar or else beyond the range of memory. And one would assume that in that kind of thing, that young people could not necessarily follow the illusions and so forth, and that they might find it Buckeye or old hat or whatever, you know. Because you're always, the writer is always in a very tentative position. He never knows when he does please, or I mean, the fact that it is on the printed page is not very important. It's a question of who reads it and what effect it produces, or how, or in some cases, how many people read it. Well, I've recently discovered that, and I've discovered it through letters I've received and through things I've heard, that there's a much wider reception of my kind of humor than I would have supposed, and I find it most gratifying, and indeed it helps me think that all the naysayers and the prophets of doom about the younger generation may be talking out of the wrong side of their mouths. It's a purely selfish reaction, mind you, but I do think that the power of the written word is illimitable, just as long as there are widening ripples of appreciation of humor and a real desire to laugh, which of course we see every day now. I mean, it's very significant that youth in every country, in England, in France and so forth, is discovering people like the Marx Brothers W.C. Fields. At the moment, in fact, I've just been told that there's a tremendous revival of pleasure in the work of Fields in both England and France. And, of course, there has been a big acceptance of the Marx Brothers for the last 10 or 15 years in England. And all this is so significant in another way, because I wrote two of their early pictures, Monkey Business and Horse Feathers, back in the very early 30s. Now that's 40 years ago, and you would have thought that you hardly would have thought that it would take four decades for this kind of work to cross that small ocean, which can be spanned in 6 hours. But it does show that eventually laughter will prevail, and I suppose that's the only measuring rod that I can have for my own work. Altogether, it's awfully hard to talk about these things without sounding pretentious. I always think that the camera and the public rostrum gives people a license to pontificate. And I happen to abhor that kind of statement. I hate the ex cathedra, the declaration that things are thus and so. The most interesting people I know and my closest friends are people who, when they talk, are very tentative. They pause and stammer and grope, and that's always the sign of a mind at work. The glib advertising salesman rolls out like a ribbon, lies flat on the brush, is to me the most offensive and repulsive form of behavior. And I mean, by now you're beginning to sense my prejudices and I suppose the sort of person I am. And if he doesn't happen to be your sort of person, then we'll be polite and pass on. But I think that there are enough people in the world, since man is basically a frightened and tentative animal, there are enough people in the world who can sympathize with that kind of belief in not being positive. It's only the politicians who are damn positive and certain about everything else, and we know how fallible they can be.
Okay.
That's a cut.
That's great.
Very good. How much is left on this tape?
How much we got left on the reel?
One of the other gratifying things to me is the acceptance and recognition of Nathaniel West as an important writer. West, as you know, was my brother-in-law, and we were very close indeed, having met originally when we were both at Brown University. I was intimately entangled.
Jerry, you got to make that statement again.
I'll make the statement again,
and then you
just say, wait a minute. Okay. Don't just say the acceptance of West. I mean, make the point the acceptance of West by the young.
I was going to get to that, but
okay,
I mean,
all right,
yeah. Don't fetch me in. I was
I'm
working toward it. Right.
I'm just saying that it's very easy because since you're going at such length,
right.
Assume you said it.
Right. Well, one of the other gratifying things to me now and throughout the last few years has been the rather wider acceptance and recognition of Nathaniel West's importance as a writer. West and I, of course, were related. He was my brother-in-law. And this was an association that had begun at Brown University back in the mid-20s and continued throughout all the years that we spent in this city and in Hollywood and so forth. As you probably know, West, during his lifetime, made no impression whatever. His books, I think, earned him a total of about $1,400 or $1,500. This was the sum total of his four novels. And it was only 7 years after his death that there began to be a few reprints of books like Miss Lonely Hearts and his earlier books. And so to speak, the ripples began to widen about 1948. And more people began reading him and hearing about him. And it was not, in an odd way, one of the phenomena about that was that he, as the work of new writers like Saul Bellow and Daniel Fuchs and so on began to be seen, Bernard Malamud and so forth, it became apparent that West had a very great influence on the thinking and the molding of these then younger writers. Today, of course, there is very wide recognition of his importance. There's been a recent biography by Jay Martin, which has told considerably more about his life, rather more than I think most people wanted to know, because Mr. Martin's book, I think, belongs to that category of biographies that we're seeing now, such as the Carlos Baker biography of Ernest Hemingway and the book about Hart Crane. I think that these books have a really built-in flaw. They pile trivia and minutiae on each other up to a point where the reader is wearied by the accumulation of small detail. It really doesn't matter how many times Hemingway had to go to the bathroom in the course of a day. That's hardly relevant to his stature as a writer. And all of this dragging forth of old telephone bills and banknotes and things of that sort and correspondence with the particular writer's dentist and so forth, all they do is succeed in causing a vast pain in the fundament. I really deplore this kind of biography, and I wish to God that some of these people who contemplate that this kind of thing would only reread Eminent Victorians by Lytton Strachey or the the many fine biographies written in the past where the subject is kept in focus and his work. And the hell with all the petty details of how he bought a broadloom carpet for $17 and had to sell it at $15 when he was broke. I'm tending to stray off the topic here. What I wanted to say is that I think that West has also had a great influence on what is called black humor, which young people are reading and seemingly enjoying a great deal. One of the people who was very much influenced by West was Terry Southern, for example. And you can see it in every line that he writes. I happen to know, though I don't know Mr. Southern personally, I happen to know that he has expressed great admiration for West's work, and properly, because West was a force. I can't say that, and I don't mean to imply at this point that Terry Southern is representative of black humor. There are other people who write in that genre. To me, that humor is black, all right, but it's not humor. Because it depends upon, intrinsically, on shock. And you know, shock is like perfume. If a pretty lady puts on a particularly beguiling scent, she can become maddening to the male animal, and especially the present speaker. But if she puts on a quart of the essence, it just don't work, honey. And that is precisely what these young writers do about shock. They think that the repetition of those four and five letter words, and we know them all, for heaven's sake. I mean, every child on every street corner has been doing the graffiti on the board fence since the dawn of time. So, fellas, I implore you, lay off this kind of thing. It just doesn't work anymore. And your job as writers is to find ingenious and new ways to say it. Now, maybe there are not new ways to describe how a man and woman go to bed together, which is a supreme and lovely act of love. But you've got to, it's no good to just try to hit them with the old hammer, because they just don't respond anymore. They're just tired of it. So give over. The other interesting thing to me as I go along that rocky pathway that leads to the stars is that you occasionally run into some very strange juxtapositions of personalities just by virtue of being around and being mobile, because the mobility is the one thing that the freelance writer, like myself, enjoys. Being a freelance is really a license to starve, but on the other hand, you starve over a great range of territory. And as long as you have a paper suitcase and they allow you to sleep in the Hotel Dixie, you can make out somehow. And in thinking about strange individuals I've seen juxtaposed, one of my fondest memories is the meeting, the actual physical meeting between Groucho Marx and T.S. Eliot. Eliot and I had been friends for, I would say, about a decade, and it happened 3-4 years ago that my wife and I were in London and were asked to dinner with Mr. and Mrs. Eliot in their flat. And halfway through the evening, Eliot said, "Oh, by the way," he said, "I'm meeting your friend Groucho Marx for the first time tomorrow night. He's coming here for dinner with his wife." Now, this had a certain background that may be fascinating. It appeared that a few years earlier, Eliot had written Groucho a fan letter, written him in Hollywood, requesting a photograph, a glossy, you know, with the well-known Marx, Lear, and all that sort of thing. And Groucho was flattered. He wasn't quite sure who Eliot was, I happen to know. His daughter Miriam had said that Eliot was a rather important poet, so forth. And Groucho, who likes literary things and people and so forth, readily assented, sent the photograph off to Eliot. Eliot then returned the photograph to Groucho and said he wanted one representing Groucho smoking a cigar. So Groucho sent off this one with the cigar. And then came another phase, because Eliot, having held this a while, returned it with a very courtly letter in which he said that he was so obliged to Groucho for his trouble, but he would really relish a photograph of him with a cigar at a particular rakish angle. Well, this began a kind of desultory correspondence between these two great minds, and they never actually met until the period of the story I'm recounting. So Eliot continued. He said, I'm meeting this man. He said, but frankly, he said, I don't know what topics we might discuss. I wonder whether you could possibly suggest a general range of things that we, he said, because the atmosphere, after all, is bound to be a bit strained and tense. So I thought a while, and I said, well, look here. I said, after all, you're both in showbiz. I said, you wrote The Cocktail Party and Murder at the Cathedral and all that. You've smelled grease paint, and so to speak. I said that, and Groucho, of course, is deeply involved in showbiz. So I said, why don't you just use that as a general subject to talk about? Well, he seemed very pleased, and he thanked me several times before we left that night. It happened that this was a Friday. The next day, on Saturday, it happened that Groucho and I were meeting Kenneth Tynan at the, what the hell's the hotel? I mean, I forgot the name of it. The Connaught, for lunch. Tynan was doing a piece about Groucho and myself for the Sunday paper for the Observer, and we were to confer about this, and Tynan was a bit detained, and Groucho and I were talking, and Groucho suddenly said, look here, he said, I'm meeting your friend Eliot, he said, tomorrow night, he said, and I've been, he said, frankly, I've been a little bit apprehensive. He said, what do I talk to this man about? He said, what does he talk to me about? He said, it sounds as though it might be a rather heavy evening. I said, well, if I could be of any assistance, I said, why don't you talk about showbiz? I said, you, after all, have been in all your life. And I said, you know, he's written these plays, The Cocktail Party and the Murder of the Cathedral and so forth. He said, by God, he said, that's an excellent idea. Thanks, old boy, you know, all that. And we went into our lunch. Well, as they say in pictures, dissolve. And about 3 weeks later, my wife and I were homeward bound on the Queen Mary, and to my surprise, I suddenly, taking my first constitutional around the deck, I ran smack into Groucho, who was wearing a linen cap and what looked like early 1920 knickers, you know, those long droopy things, and chewing rather gloomily on a cigar, looking rather depressed, and I said, well, let's have a cup of tea or something, and we went in the smoking room, and I said, tell me, whatever happened on that Saturday night when you dined with the Eliots? And he said, oh my God, he said, the four of us just sat there, he said, we hardly exchanged a word, he said, you could hear the clicking of our dentures, he said, we got through the fish, and he said, and the next step to the roast was just forever, and he said, we somehow got through the evening. He said, we were both very abashed. He said, it was simply awful. Now, there's sort of a postscript to this, because Eliot died not long after, and there was held in Westminster Abbey, finally, there was held a memorial at which a lot of very consequential people spoke, and spoke with great weight and solemnity about Eliot's contribution, and one thing or another. And the evening, obviously, I was not there, but I've been told by people who are, the evening slowly went downhill. The last speaker on the bill was Groucho. And Groucho got up and read a few verses from Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which was one of Tom Elliott's lighter books. And he read this with such vivacity and with such gaiety that it lifted the entire evening up. Everyone was laughing, and it was practically standing applause by the time he finished. And in other words, Groucho rescued the entire thing. I just think it's a charming relationship to have been able to see summer between these men.
Okay, we made it?
Yeah, no, because we were racing this goddamn tape.
Tape, I knew that, yeah.
That's the only reason I was bothering you.
We just made it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
That was miraculous. Good boy.